Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Francine is joined by Dr. Carrie Gross. Dr. Gross is Associate Professor of General Medicine and the Associate Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
So let's start off, Carrie, by talking a little bit about where you came from and what got you interested in this field and how you actually got to Yale.
So I've been here at Yale for about 10 years, and my interest in treating the older patient with cancer really started when I was a young physician in training. I was a chief resident at Sloan Kettering in the late 1990s. And at that time, it became apparent to me that the majority of our patients that were being admitted to the service were older patients who not only had cancer, but a variety of non-cancer conditions and problems that they were facing. Now, I'm a general internist. I've always wanted to be a primary care doctor. And during that time, taking care of these cancer patients, I became very concerned about how the primary care physicians can interact with medical oncologists and how we can all potentially do a better job learning about taking care of cancer patients.
Can you just tell us what old means nowadays?
That's a great question. Old is not and should not be defined as any chronologic age. I would actually suggest that we consider maybe using terms frail and not frail, or just healthy and not healthy, because as we all know, there are some patients or some people over the age of 80 who are running marathons, and some people who are 65 who are quite debilitated.
You talked about seeing these patients in the general medicine setting. Is it true that many of these frail patients are actually being handled by primary care doctors and internal medicine doctors and not really by medical oncologists?
Absolutely. There are, certainly when we are considering treating the older patient with cancer, the oncologist would be involved at some point. However, sometimes patients don't make it into the door of the oncologist's office if the diagnosing physician is assessing the patient and thinks that they may not be fit or suitable or able to tolerate the therapy. And that leads actually to the other factor which really led to my interest in older patients with cancer, and that is furthering our understanding of how older patients, or maybe I should say, use my own terms, how the frail patient is able to tolerate cancer treatment and cancer screening, cancer therapies. So when I was initially finished with my clinical training, I did a two-year research fellowship. And during that time, I became very interested in the process of research and really studying what are we trying to do when we're conducting research at the national level. Are we just trying to generate new information, or are we really trying to improve the health and healthcare of our population? So the first study I did looking at this topic of research was to look at patients who were enrolled in trials funded by the National Cancer Institute, or the NCI. And what we found was that only about 3% of adults under the age of 65 who had cancer were being enrolled in cancer research studies. And just as a point of information, for comparison, if you look at children with cancer, over 70% are enrolled in research studies. And this different culture, this widespread participation in research is partly responsible for the tremendous gains that we've made in reducing the mortality rate of childhood cancers. So, like I said, we found about 3% of adults were enrolled in research. But then older adults, it decreased even further. Age of 65 to 75, only about 1% were being included in research studies. Over the age of 75, less than 0.5%. So if you translate these numbers into a plain take-home message, what we're finding is that there's really a paucity of data that's applicable to the older cancer patient to help guide decision-making. Now, I did one other study where we were looking at what happens after a study was published. And here we looked at a new surgical procedure. And what we found was that the study that was published was a randomized trial where they took people up to the age of 80, and they randomized half of these people to get this surgical procedure on their neck. It was called a carotid endarterectomy to prevent strokes. And half the people were randomized to not undergo this surgery. And the take-home point from this this publication was that under the age of 80, there was a modest benefit to undergoing this procedure. And also the take-home point from the authors was that this trial was only done at hospitals that were very experienced, and by surgeons who were very experienced in conducting the procedure. But what we found when we looked at Medicare data to look at patients who had actually been operated on and who were eligible for the surgery was that after this research study was published, patients over the age of 80 who would not have even been eligible for the study were even more likely to undergo the surgery than patients who are younger than 80. And similarly, patients who are at the low volume or low volume hospitals, patients who are at hospitals that had a higher mortality rate were actually more likely to undergo the procedure. So the take-home point from that study, which was very disturbing and concerning for me, was that not only are older patients not being enrolled in studies, but when these studies are then published, actually the results are affecting care of the older patient, sometimes leading to interventions that could potentially do more harm than good.
So in terms of why the older patients were not on the clinical trials, I think it was only recently that the NCI didn't have an age cutoff. I remember we used to have an age cutoff of 65 for a lot of these clinical trials, and now we don't have that. Have you seen more patients going into trials now that there isn't an age cutoff, or do you think that there are other problems that are keeping these older patients off the trial?
There has been an increased interest, and I do think there are more older patients going on to research studies, but there are still important barriers because some studies do not have an explicit age cutoff, but they still may have certain health problems which could preclude you from joining the study. So if a new study says we don't want anybody who has emphysema or heart failure or kidney disease, but you can be any age, the take-home problem from that type of of an inclusion criteria is that older patients are more likely to have these conditions, and therefore they're less likely to join. But there are a number of encouraging signs toward generating more evidence that's applicable to the older patient.
I think one of the things inherent in what you just said goes back to your example with the surgery, and that is that because we don't have experience treating these patients with severe medical issues, kidney failure, liver issues on clinical trials, we don't have experience with the drugs in that setting. And then once these things get approved, they're used, you know, in the community, perhaps in patients that maybe don't meet those strict criteria. And so we don't have a lot of experience using the drugs in that setting.
Absolutely. And this speaks to the way research is designed. Our system of research in our country is really broken. If you think about it, there are two halves of the research process. One half, in my perfect world, would be developing these new treatment strategies and bringing them to the market, bringing them to the bedside. And then there's the second half, which would start after FDA approval or after the initial research study is completed. Then we want to see what happens in the real world when these drugs or agents are being used, and particularly for the frail elderly patient. We need to do a better job of generating evidence after the new treatments come to market.
So, Carrie, just in general, we've talked a little bit about this, but really if you come right down to it, how much data is out there to really help us to guide in the screening and treatment of older patients with cancer? We have the NCCN guidelines, which address diseases as a whole, but I don't believe that they really break it down by age. Are there any guidelines at this point, or are there any sources of information out there?
There are very few guidelines that are specific to the older patient because, as you rightfully say, that there's a paucity of evidence. Now, guidelines are very helpful in guiding treatment decisions. And even when there is no evidence, sometimes guidelines are written, or actually frequently guidelines are written when there's no firm evidence that can help provide some expert consensus opinion about what is felt to be the best approach to take. However, because there's so little evidence for treating the older patient, most guidelines, even with the expert consensus, even when there's no evidence at all, don't feel obliged or maybe appropriate including these age-specific recommendations.
Another issue that we actually run into in clinical practice, particularly with our lymphoma patients who we expect to cure with chemotherapy, is that oftentimes if a patient is older, they won't get full dose treatment. There's also the bias on the part of some physicians that you should modify the doses of treatment for older people. Is that a problem from your point of view, and do you see any way that perhaps we could address that?
It's a problem if there's no evidence to support it. Certainly, we expect our physicians to make decisions based upon the information that they have at hand regarding what would be the best for their patient. So certainly, one should not be criticized for a dose reduction, for giving a lower dose of chemo if you think it will do harm. But what I'm trying to promote is the attitude that we need to generate this evidence. And wouldn't it be great if we had a health system where when older patients are being evaluated for treatment of their lymphoma, if they could say to you, you know, Dr. Foss, what about patients like me? What about somebody who actually can't walk up a flight of stairs and have kidney disease? Can you look back at the past, you know, 5 years of data nationally and tell me what happens when I get chemo? And then if their data were out there, and the frustrating thing for me as a researcher, as a clinician, is that these data are out there. I mean, there are patients all across the country being treated that have very similar and very common problems, but we're just not capturing the data yet. So we can really then collect it and feed it back to the researchers and feed it back to the clinicians so that patients could then make informed decisions.
Well, we have the what we call the ECOG performance status. That's a way we assess older, or anybody actually, for a clinical trial. We assess them based on basically whether or not they're ambulatory and can dress themselves, a kind of basic level of functioning. And that's kind of a rough score from 0 to 4. Do you think that a score like that, if we perhaps were a little bit more specific, it included more elements, that something like that perhaps could help us?
Absolutely, especially including more elements. At Yale Cancer Center, we have been part of a multi-institutional study where we are enrolling or have enrolled over 500 geriatric cancer patients. And again, speaking to the definition of age, we defined it as you had to be over the age of 65 and about to receive chemotherapy for cancer. And we collected quite a few variables, including the ECOG performance status, but also we asked these patients, Can you dress yourself? Do you need help shopping? How far can you walk? A lot of geriatric specific issues. What we found was that when we included some of these geriatric questions and domains, our ability to identify patients who are going to run into trouble as far as developing toxicity from their chemotherapy was much improved. So what we found was that we were able to identify one group of patients that had very few of these problems, where only about 20% would develop a toxicity reaction. And the patients who were older and more frail and had more of these baseline disabilities, over 80% were developing disability. So this is just starting out this research process, but there's definitely ways that we can help to guide decision making.
Great. We'd like to talk a little bit more about that after we break for a medical minute. Stay tuned to learn more about cancer in the elderly from Dr. Carrie Gross.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer. And in Connecticut alone, there will be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking. And quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they have ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery at Yale Cancer Center is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my guest today, Dr. Carrie Gross. And we're discussing cancer care in the older or more frail patient. Before the break, Carrie, we talked a bit about this clinical trial that you did, actually looking at elderly patients enrolled in cancer treatment at Yale. And you told us that you identified some factors that predicted whether or not those patients would have a good outcome. Do you want to just go through what some of those were?
Sure. So we looked at, as I mentioned, a variety of factors. We did find, not surprisingly, that increasing age was associated with a higher risk of toxicity, but it wasn't the single strongest predictor. We also found that people taking multiple medications, people who have kidney problems, people who needed help with some of their activities of daily living, again, such as bathing, shopping, taking care of themselves. And finally, one thing that was interesting was people who had social isolation, people with less social support, were also more likely to develop a toxicity reaction. And the interesting thing is when we compared these factors with the physician assessment of the patient's performance status, the physician assessment was no longer helpful. So it was basically a few simple questions might help us to do a better job than actually just having the physician eyeball the patient and predict who's going to develop toxicity.
So these were questions that the patient actually answered, a questionnaire that the patient answered?
Yes. And then our goal now is to then take this initial study and validate it, meaning by confirming our findings in another population of patients with cancer.
I was just going to bring up that point, and that is that the study was done primarily at Yale. Or was it done also in community settings? Because perhaps there's a difference in terms of the patient populations.
That's a great question. It was done actually at, I think, about 10 different medical centers, but it was all academic medical centers that were participating in this project. And yes, there are definitely differences in the approach to treatment and in the mean age of the patients. Academic medical centers tend to have younger, healthier patients than community oncologists do. So in the future, I think it will be important to include both the academic and the community providers.
Can you talk a little bit about the extrapolation of this kind of research on a national level? I mean, are there national studies looking at these same kinds of issues?
So the goal of this geriatric oncology research team is to integrate this geriatric assessment, is what we're calling it, into other ongoing studies. So led by Dr. Arthi Hurria at City of Hope, this initial assessment is being actually integrated into some large NCI-sponsored clinical trials so that they could assess the impact of these geriatric effectors on patient outcomes. But my hope is that eventually this would become something that becomes integrated into clinical care so that it's part of your initial forms that you fill out, if you will, when you're seen by the doctor, is not only your insurance information, but also a rigorous assessment of your health status.
Carrie, can you talk a little bit about what other steps have been made in recent years to enroll more older patients in research studies, and has this been changing over the last couple of years?
Yeah, there have been a few exciting developments. One is that there are some changes to the way studies are being designed. A few moments ago, we talked about removing these age cutoffs, no longer excluding patients over the age of 65. But actually, if you take that a step further, there are some other studies which have a new concept toward an age minimum. So actually there are some studies which only include patients over the age of 70 or over the age of 75, because there are some questions that are really pertinent and can only be, for the elderly, that can only be answered by looking at the older population. So for instance, one study of radiation after breast-conserving surgery for women with breast cancer was published about 4 years ago. And in this study, they looked at patients who were over the age of 70 with small, favorable risk tumors, meaning that they had a low likelihood of metastasis. And by focusing on this group, they really answered the question, do these women really need to get radiation, or maybe they'll be okay without it? And what they found was that 4% of these women who had received radiation had a recurrence of their breast cancer, and only 1% of women who did receive radiation. So it was a 4% versus 1% difference. And some actual editorials and guidelines after this study was published highlighted that there was only a 3% absolute difference in the risk of a breast cancer recurrence, and suggested that older women should be provided with this information and told that, listen, if you don't get radiation, there's a 96% chance you're not going to have a recurrence. If you do get radiation, it's a 99% chance. So you have to really make up your mind. Did you really to raise your chances from 96% to 99%, do you want to get the radiation? And that's a question that each person needs to decide for themselves. But the key issue is that now we have the data so we can present it to older patients.
Do you think that in terms of the eligibility criteria for some of these large national trials, that there should be some loosening of the criteria to take into consideration the fact that some of the more frail people don't have the best kidney function and they don't have the best liver function, for instance?
Absolutely. I would love to see a new requirement for research proposals that describe the target population in terms of their health status. For instance, say that 20% of women with breast cancer have kidney problems and 30% have diabetes. Now, I don't know those numbers for sure, but just for argument's sake. Wouldn't it be great if in your research study proposal you had to really explain if you're going to exclude people with diabetes or kidney problems and therefore exclude that 60, 70% of women, 30, 40% of women from the potential to benefit from your research, you need to explain why. So I think we need to relax the enrollment criteria for research studies. However, there are different types of studies, and I think it's fine for initial testing of a new potentially toxic therapy if you want to really restrict it to patients who we feel are most likely to benefit. But then that's the next step beyond that. What we need to do is then say, okay, it worked in the young, healthy patients. Now let's try it in other patients who are not sure if they'll tolerate the treatment.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the ethical issues that come up in terms of dealing with older patients in clinical trials? For instance, you know, there might be some ethical issues in terms of whether or not a physician even presents a trial to a patient.
That's the first thing I was going to say, actually. So the first ethical issue I would say is that we need to include these patients in our studies if we're treating them. And it's not ethical to continue to try to make decisions in a vacuum, unless we're trying at least to fill that vacuum. Obviously, we shouldn't coerce patients and say they have to enroll in a study, but all patients should be offered the opportunity to participate in a study. Now, in addition to that, there are a few more ethical concerns for all patients, but particularly for the older patient. And one is this issue of family dynamics, of really understanding who is making the decisions and who really wants to be in a research study, or who really wants the aggressive treatment and who doesn't. And I think it's really important to make sure that, when appropriate, the patient themselves is really the one who's steering the car, and that they are not being pushed into getting a more aggressive therapy or pushed into enrolling in a study by a family member. So these family dynamics and issues of control are important for all patients, but particularly for older patients. And the third issue, and this relates to the issue of, I said, when appropriate the patient should be in the driver's seat. And what I meant by that is it's important to recognize that there are cognitive impairments, and there is an increased risk of dementia with increasing age. And even patients in their 60s have about 5% of patients in their 60s have dementia. Another 10 to 15% may have mild cognitive impairment. But when you get up into the 80s, more than 10% will have dementia, and another 20% will have mild cognitive impairment. So it's important that we, as treating physicians, are really assessing patients to make sure that they have the capacity to make decisions about their care.
And in addition to that, there are ways that we can still offer those cognitively impaired patients treatments. It's just that we have to go through decision makers.
Absolutely, and make sure that the people who are charged with making decisions with and for that patient are included in the process.
Can you talk a little bit about the whole process of cancer screening for older people? And do you think that there are also biases in terms of whether or not older people are offered cancer screening to the same degree as younger people?
Here, I think the bias actually may be towards over-screening. There are very few studies that are providing evidence for us about whether screening works. So let me give you an example. For a mammography, for breast cancer screening, there was recently a very thorough review of the literature, and they looked at, as a function of age, the authors compiled all of the evidence from all studies that have been done. They found that for women in their 40s, there were 8 large randomized trials. And they found there was very good evidence that mammography is helpful. But in their 40s, it turns out it was only a little bit helpful. In that age group, you had to invite about 2,000 women to get a mammogram to save one life. Then in their 50s, they found 6 studies that looked at the effect of mammography. In the 60-year-old age group, there were only 2 studies that looked at mammography, and it was found to be helpful there. 400 women needed to be offered mammography in order to save one life. But then up in the end of the 70s, the authors only found 1 study looking at the impact of mammography on health outcomes. And actually, that study did not find any benefit from mammography. And because it was only 1 study, the take-home point from this review is not that we shouldn't do any mammography. It was just that there's just not enough evidence to make a decision. So against this backdrop of a lack of evidence, I think what we tend to do is to continue to offer screening. And there's several reasons for this. Our country, if you think about our health system, the deck is really stacked towards treatment. We have a fee-for-service system, so physicians and hospitals are reimbursed when they do more. Some people may be concerned about litigation, so there's this concern about defensive medicine, so it makes us want to do more. Think about mammography in particular, but cancer screening. We are putting out these postage stamps and billboards and all these public service announcements, and no one's ever saying, well, you know, over the age of 75, no one knows if it's really helpful or not, because it might not be. So there are these messages towards screening. So everything's gearing up toward more and more and more screening, and it becomes challenging when you're considering the older patient who might not benefit to try to reach a decision or have that conversation about why someone might not benefit. Because the idea is the impact of screening takes years to begin to accrue. So again, using mammography as an example, if you get a mammogram today, and then again a year from now, the benefit of mammography really doesn't begin for 5 years. And the reason for that is because mammography helps patients by diagnosing their early stage, very, very early stage cancers. Those are the tumors that will be removed and will result in a decrease in your risk of mortality. If you do a mammogram and find a metastatic cancer, the mammogram probably didn't help you nearly so much. So given the fact that there's a 5-year lag time between starting a cancer screening intervention and even beginning to get some benefit, as people age and their life expectancy becomes shorter, it's important to consider that the benefits will decrease with time.
So, Carrie, are there clinical trials or other areas of research in this area that we should know about?
Yeah, there are a couple really interesting developments. One is comparative effectiveness research, and that is something that's been pretty politicized and is kind of a hot-button issue. But the idea behind comparative effectiveness research is to compare existing treatments in the population, in the real world. And this is especially pertinent to the older patient. So in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that was passed a couple of years ago, there was $1.1 billion devoted toward this comparative effectiveness research to help us understand which treatments are better. Now, if you compare that to the fact that we have $800 billion being spent on healthcare, it's still a drop in the bucket, but it's a great step in the right direction toward helping us to decide what's the best way to treat our patients in the community.
Dr. Carrie Gross is Associate Professor of General Medicine and the Associate Director of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.